Blind Cool Tech. We're fun.
Well, I wanted to play with podcast stuff, okay?
Technology.
Cool.
Is anybody there?
And blindness.
Ah, God. Who put that wall there?
Can all come together. It's another Blind Cool Tech special guest presentation.
The research department at American Printing House for the Blind has project leaders for several different areas. I'm the technology project leader. There's a Braille, a low vision, and in the office with me today is Fred Otto, one of the project leaders for tactile graphics. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Larry.
How's it going, man?
Doing okay. I was visiting your neck of the woods, or your part of the building here, because we had a meeting a few doors down, and it was a meeting about a new tactile graphic product that's hitting the shelves soon, except that we found a number of production problems with it, and it looks like we're going to have to be putting a hold on the sales of it and making a few corrections and stuff, so...
Is it something you can tell us about?
Yeah, it's actually a really neat product. It's for a long time we've known that children need a lot of practice in reading tactile graphics. In other words, you can't just take a blind child and start shoving tactile pictures and graphs and charts and things in front of the child and expect him or her to instantly make sense of them. You have to kind of build up their skills, their hand skills, their ability to scan a page and find things, and then also to track lines around as they move around the page, things like that. And so what our product is called Squid. We picked kind of a kid-friendly, goofy name with a little bit of that gross factor that's appealing to youngsters. And it's a collection of tactile activities, mazes, puzzles, games, things to get your hands moving, things to get you exploring. And there are activities that a blind child can do right alongside with... their classmates or their sighted brothers and sisters or by themselves. So
I guess what you're saying is a big part of this is teaching a blind child how to read a tactile graphic, just like a sighted person would have to learn to read a map, so
exactly.
To speak.
Exactly. Yeah. When you consider that sighted children get an awful lot of, I guess we'd say, incidental exposure to things just by... looking around in the world, and you see maps everywhere.
Yeah.
Of course, there is some teaching that goes on with those, teaching them how to understand symbols and legends on a map and that sort of thing. But a lot of that learning occurs more or less by osmosis when you have sight because of your constant exposure to them.
Sure.
But with a blind child, they're not getting as near that level of exposure, and so we find that we have to really do some more intentional kind of teaching with them.
Yeah.
And that starts with things, as I said, like just the ability to trace a line as it moves from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your finger on that line, and suppose there's another line that comes, suppose you're following a dotted line, but there's another dashed line or a smooth line that goes across it. Well, you want to make sure your finger stays on the dotted line and isn't distracted by these other things. So in order to build up those kind of skills, we might say there's an activity in our Squid magazine. It's called Beat Me to the Punchline. And it has three corny jokes on the left side of the page in a column, and then it has their three corny punchlines on the right side. And then it has three different textured lines that snake in and out and around about the page, connecting each joke with its punchline. So you read the joke, and then you have to follow and stay on that line as it twists and turns around to get to its punchline on the other side of the page.
Okay.
And just as an example, I'll ask you this.
I was about to ask.
What do you do if you meet a starving cannibal?
What do you do?
You should give him a hand. That's the quality of material we're talking about.
I think you should have put the mother-in-law cannibal joke in there, man. That's my favorite.
Tell that one.
Well, you mean with the two cannibals that were eating dinner, and one of them mutters over to the other one, he says, "You know, I hate my mother-in-law." And the other one says, "Well, try the potatoes."
I still like that joke.
Fred, you mentioned an example of something that seemed, you know, pretty elementary following the line. How do you teach something like spatial relationships on a tactile graphic where you might have the student using both their hands to discover things about the graphic?
Well, that's an ongoing question. If you're referring to things like 3D objects, that's the big stumper that has mystified and puzzled the teaching world I don't think it's been resolved yet. If you are trying to present a cube or a stack of cubes in three dimensions, that's just a really difficult thing to do to make it comprehensible to a blind student, because you can do certain things with in print that give the illusion of 3D-ness, of depth, and those things are really hard to do in a tactile way, in a way that's meaningful. Now, along those lines, have you interviewed Karen Pope yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, well, she's a coworker. We work side by side in the tactile graphics area of the research department, and she is developing a project now called Stack Ups, which is going to be geared to exactly that task. It's going to have some cubes in it, and they're going to have Velcro attached to different sides of them. They'll have the sticky and the fuzzy side, and then there'll also be some tactile pictures so that the teacher will make a little elementary stack of cubes by sticking them together on the Velcro, and then show the corresponding tactile graphic view of that. So the student can examine them in both their 3D form by holding it in their hands, and then also look at the representation of that as a simple raised line picture on a page, and try to build up the connection that way.
Now, do you use the same techniques in a line drawing that sighted people use, like convergence and?
Well, yeah, and that part I believe can be. I don't know that there's a lot of research to show this, but a concept like convergence can be made understandable. For instance, I think what you're talking about is how when you're showing how two lines going away from you eventually appear to meet, as if you're looking down railroad tracks and they converge into one line. There is an analog to that in the realm of sound. Namely, you can, in other words, you can give a sound representation of that phenomenon by having a person stand close to two speakers that are separated, and then gradually either move the person away from the speakers or the speakers back away from the person. When the distance gets far enough, of course, the sounds seem to be getting closer and closer and closer together until eventually they're indistinguishable. It sounds like they're coming from one point.
Good point.
And that's a way that you can, at least get across the idea of convergence that way.
Yeah.
But in general, in a tactile graphic, you can. It's really hard to show those kinds of illusions, and have them make sense. So we always encourage people, say, if you're doing a tactile version of a science diagram, say a cross section of the skin, the epidermis and the dermis and the follicles and all the pores and all that stuff, that's always in a textbook, it's always presented as a 3D picture. And we would encourage someone, if they were doing a tactile picture of that, to convert it into not a 3D perspective diagram, but a 2D head-on view of the thing.
Okay.
In order to simplify it.
So with these tactile graphics, it sounds like you're teaching people how to read them, but you also need to teach people a way to create them, huh?
Exactly. That's a tough part.
I bet. The
hardest thing with teachers, transcribers, people who are trying to create tactile graphics that are going to be readable and really useful to a blind student, the hardest thing is to break them of the habit of making the tactile graphic look just like the print graphic.
Yeah.
They what we always tell people to do is to think tactile, and which means to really put yourself into the mindset, the point of view, and the experience of the person who's going to be reading that with their hands. And when you do that, it's not so important that the graphic be pretty or that it be looking exactly like the print graphic. What's important is that it be clear, that there be some separation between the items in it so that you can tell one thing from another, that it's not too cluttered, and that there be appropriate labels so that you're not guessing what the various parts of it are.
Okay. What are some of the tools that are available to create tactile graphics?
There's a whole range. In fact, in the U.S., we have people making tactile graphics in a wide variety of ways. I'll start at the low-tech end of the scale. You can make tactile graphics out of simple craft materials that you may have readily available, and that we call this like the collage method generally. You would take a piece of paper or cardboard as your base, and then you might cut out shapes out of different textures of paper or cloth, fabric, different things, and glue them on to represent your land masses and your bodies of water. And then you might use little dots of some sort to stand for your point symbols, you know, your capital cities and so on. And you might take pieces of string dip your fingers in some Elmer's glue and run the string through your gluey fingers, and then glue it down that way onto the page and to make your streets or your rivers or your outlines, that sort of thing. That's the collage method. Oh, and another set of tools that's useful for that is to get some tracing wheels or spur wheels from a sewing equipment or a craft store. And this would be like little pizza cutter kind of wheels with little spikes or spurs on them that you run across the paper, and it leaves a dotted line. Of course, the dotted line is on the reverse side of the paper, so you have to kind of think backwards when you're doing that. You have to tool it from the back side of the paper so that the dots will be on the front when you flip it over. So that's the essence of the collage method. And then a lot of schools have embraced the swell paper technology. That is, that goes by various names, but in its essence, it's a special kind of paper that has a little layer of some chemical inside it, and you can draw on the paper with a heavy carbon wax pencil, or you can run the paper through a Xerox copier, or whatever copier, and deposit an image on it that way with that black toner. And at that point, it's still not tactile. There's one more step you have to go through, which is to run the paper with the image on it through a special device, which some people call the toaster, the Barbie oven, the Easy Bake oven, or the image enhancer. And there are various brands of these. And it has an infrared heating element in it. When you run the paper through it, the parts of the paper that have the black high carbon image on them swell up, and the rest of the paper doesn't swell, or doesn't swell but just a little bit. So you end up with these black images that are raised up above the background surface. and you have a pretty quick way to make a tactile
graphic.
Yeah,
that sounds pretty easy.
And it is.
Fairly inexpensive, I take it.
The paper costs close to $1 a sheet, so you can't go around wasting it. But it is pretty reasonable for the initial investment in the paper and the toaster. Just going up from there, there are other technologies. A real big one that used to be used a lot was thermoforming. And that basically consists of using these sheets of vinyl. And you have a master or an original that you've made with the collage method or by embossing some heavy sheet of real heavy aluminum foil. Use that to make your original diagram. And then you take it over to your thermoform machine and you can make multiple copies of that over and over and over. So that if you have a big group of people or you want to make a lot of copies of the same graphic, you don't have to create it again and again. You create it once and then you run copies with the thermoform machine. And what it does is it takes this sheet of vinyl and it heats it real quick and then it sucks it down. That's the vacuum form procedure. It sucks it down onto your original. And after a few seconds, you lift it off and you've got an exact copy of that original on this sheet of vinyl. And that that's a really neat process because it lets you get a lot of variation in the heights of things at different levels of relief so that you can have things that stick way up and are very prominent and other things that are just a little bit back there in the background and everything in between so that you can really make some nice kind of sculptural graphics that way. But that method, that whole process of making a master and thermoforming it, that involves time and effort, and a lot of people aren't very secure about trusting their skills to do that well. Mm-hmm. And so that process has kind of taken a backseat to the swell paper method that I talked about before.
You know, that's actually a shame because it seems like you can get such more clear and precise representations mm-hmm. on the thermoform than you do the swell paper.
You really can. I'm a big fan of it. And we do a lot of products here with thermoforming or vacuum forming. They really mean the same thing, just two different terms. And we're really partial to that because we feel like you can get the real accuracy and detail that you want in certain things. And sometimes this thermoform material has gotten a little bit of bad press because some people don't like the way it feels under their fingers. It has a certain there's this material called Braylon that was the standard for a lot of years. And a lot of people complained that it felt a little staticky or sweaty or they just had a bad reaction to it with their fingers. So I guess that's another reason why a lot of people have bailed out on that one. Of course, there's a lot of people who find it just really the thing.
Yeah. So there's some higher tech ways of creating these too, right?
There are a lot of those. You get up into money, and some of these are just only found in commercial enterprises like the printing house or other places that are doing mass production of tactile materials. One that we developed here in house is a way of embossing paper. And you, if anybody has grown up using APH textbooks or tests that we have adapted, you're probably familiar with these paper graphics that have embossed images on them. And we do that with a machine that we developed in-house called the Pearl Machine. And basically, it's like a glorified sewing machine. It operates with a part that goes up and down, blah, 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 blah. And as it's going up and down, it's embossing these images onto this kind of heavy metal plate. Not real heavy, but a durable metal plate. And the operator is guiding the plate around to make the image while she's running a foot pedal that's causing the stamper to go up and down, blah, 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 blah. And so what you get from that is this plate that has this image tooled on it, and it could have dotted and smooth lines and textures and patterns and point symbols and all these things. And then to make a bunch of copies off of that, you carry that plate over to a big press, which we call a clamshell press. And that is basically just this enormous picture of a clamshell with its mouth going open and closed, open and closed. And you're dropping a sheet of paper into it. When its mouth is open, its mouth slams shut. And when it opens again, you grab the piece of paper out and drop another one in. And each time you do that, it's embossing the image from that metal plate onto your sheet of paper. And when you watch these press operators back there, it's really kind of like a dance or a ballet. It almost looks like they're swimming, because with one hand they're reaching forward, grabbing, lifting the paper out from the gaping maw of the clamshell, and with the other hand they're sweeping back, grabbing a new sheet of paper off the stack and dropping it in, all while the gaping maw is still open. And so there's this back and forth, round and about rhythm that they develop in relation to the machine.
Yeah.
And Lord help them if they get off the rhythm, because you definitely don't want to get your hand anywhere near that machine when it's coming, when it's shutting its big mouth.
Well, yeah, that always reminds me of, I don't know if you ever read Mad Magazine when you were a kid, but they had one cartoon I particularly remember was the lady says, "Get your thumb off that scale," talking to the butcher.
Uh-huh.
And the picture of it, he had cut his thumb off and was on there with the meat. Well, that's don't look for an imprint of a thumb in your tactile graphics. I guess there's some other high-tech ways. Let me just jump back a sec, though. People can be creative about how they create how they make these tactile graphics, I've noticed over the years, with different textures and so forth. And I even had an instance one time I had mentioned to my mom that I really was interested in the city map of Texarkana, I believe it was, where we were living at the time. And she did something I thought worked out pretty good. She just took a regular road map and used and traced out the major streets, or just followed them with some Elmer's glue.
Oh, okay.
Just a little line of glue along them, you know.
There you go. Yeah, that's so, the basic level.
Yeah, yeah, that's that first method you were talking about, I guess.
Yeah, the kitchen table method.
What about other higher tech, I guess, money ways to do this?
Well, let's see. I'll probably omit something, but there's another technique that we have in-house that you, if you associate with the printing house over the years, you'll probably come across some things that we put out using this technology. And this one is like a modified Xerox machine that can produce a fairly low relief raised image on right on top of the paper. And the way it does this is this modified Xerox machine. You take your image and you put a piece of paper into it, which has the image on it that you want to be made tactile. And you start it up, and it'll make basically like a Xerox copy. What it'll do is it will spit out a piece of paper with that image on it in some ink that is still wet. So that wet ink is still sitting right there on top of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And all this takes just a few seconds. I'm slowing it down, but it's, you know, it's done before you can really bat your eyes. There's the image in wet ink. And then some of this particular powder, is this real fine resinous kind of powder, is thrown down onto that image, and it sticks to the wet parts. And then the next thing is that same powder is sucked back up with a vacuum. So it's thrown down and sucked up real quick. And the only places where that powder is supposed to stick are to the wet ink. And then the next and final thing is it passes through this heater, which is somewhere in the range of 1,000 degrees. And it passes through that real quickly. And that ink and powder combination is baked on real quick. And what you end up with is this baked on image, which sits right on top of the paper. Mm. That whole thing from front to back is called, we call it the green machine. It's also called tactile vision process. And it's something that we've had in-house for a few years. And we use it for certain things because it is relatively inexpensive. But we also recognize that it's not really a perfect or a great technique for every tactile graphic purposes. We were talking a minute ago about the how neat it is when you can get all kinds of different patterns, textures, and levels of relief on a graphic, and how much more information you can convey that way. And as opposed to a process like this one that I'm describing, where you get a lot of lines that are exactly the same height, and it's pretty low, and so you don't have you can't get the same kind of complexity or detail with a process like that.
I'm actually amazed at how much complexity and detail you can get from that process, though. No, it's not as good as thermoform, but the stuff that that we've done here and that Ed has shown people at various conferences, it's really quite impressive. I wouldn't have thought it.
Yeah, I think the difficulty comes with things like graphs, or like an XY graph where you have the axes and the grid lines, and then you have the curve or the equation that's been plotted on top of that, and maybe you'll have a couple lines that are going in different directions and intersecting, and sometimes you'll have an area that's supposed to be shaded in, because everything less, y less than 2 or something is shaded in. That's where the green machine process is really difficult, or where a process like thermoform might really shine, because what you would ideally like to have is the grid lines to be very much in the background, so that they're almost out of the way, and your attention can be focused on the equations that are plotted on top of that, or the texture or whatever. And you would look for a material that would allow you to have different levels of relief to do something like that.
Man, are we going to ever have a interactive tactile display?
You tell me. That's your job.
That's in my department.
That's your department. Well, you know what we will have? Very possibly, Lord willing, in our lifetimes. There's a lot of attention now on this whole rapid prototyping industry. And that is, they're not developing that necessarily with us or blind people in mind, but the spin-offs of that and the way that that is moving from a big manufacturing kind of bailiwick down to something that could be accomplished even on a desktop in an office. Those days are coming along pretty rapidly. I think it's not going to be a long time before we see the ability to do a drawing on a computer with some sort of a CAD or a drawing program, and then in not too long a time actually produce a raised model or a tactile model using these rapid prototyping equipment.
And you know what I always find a good way to explain to people how this rapid prototyping process works is with these 3D puzzles. I'm sure you've seen these, Fred, where you have a puzzle like the American bald eagle or whatever.
Okay.
And it's actually layers. And
you
build, and when you're through, you have a three-dimensional representation, because each each puzzle piece is actually a slice, as if you horizontally sliced through this thing, like an eighth of an inch thick or something.
So you've got the eagle who's projecting up from the blue sky background.
Really, it's more of a thing where he's just sitting on a pedestal. The whole puzzle is just like the pedestal or the branch or whatever. And then
so he's
the
like a little model of
yeah, it really turns out
from
to be
all
a,
sides.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that's the way this rapid prototyping works is everything is represented in a real thin layer. Then they just keep getting added and added and added. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of neat discussions about these and in the realm of, you know, wouldn't it be a really neat concept to be able to fax you an object? And really all it would require is that you had a machine that was able to reproduce this data that was sent to you. So, but really, yeah, that's cool and all, but the interactive part is like the holy grail, you know?
Something that is actually flowing under your fingertips kind
of thing. That, or that you could show a map on your screen and then look at it and, you know, then change it and then look at it again. Mm-hmm. And also the whole idea of animation, you know, how do you represent animation to a blind child?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if it's that important a concept or not, but it,
well, it depends on where the mainstream kind of education goes. If they turn to animation as a classroom tool.
Yeah, true.
Where actual content and concepts are being taught, then you kind of have to find a way to follow suit. I mean, if they're just being used for decoration or for a cute effect, then that's debatable.
What do you think about the applicability of virtual reality towards tactile graphics, where you don't necessarily actually have a physical object, but you have the perception of one, so to speak?
I guess if it's convincing enough, if it's real enough and it's handy enough. I mean, I would not want to like have to don a huge suit and be hooked up to a lot of electrodes and look like Terminator or something in order to read a simple graph or something. But that's, you know, who knows where that'll come in time.
And it's kind of interesting to think, too, that it might be as simple as just putting on a pair of gloves and say you were looking at a model of a molecule and you needed more detail, you know, you could actually zoom in and make the molecule a foot wide or whatever.
Oh, man, yeah. In between the different atoms or particles
and see
how they related to each other.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about, like, that rapid prototyping and how that is eventually going to come to an office near you. And I think it will, and I think that will be a pretty neat effect, but there's, you know, it's not like I'm totally in love with all the technology, because I think there's always going to be the appeal of the hands-on creation of these things. You know, there are certain things that you can see the craftsmanship that went into it.
In tactile
graphics, and those are just really appealing, and you know, some of the things that we make here as products, educational aids that we put out, are we conceive them, and then we work with Tom Pope. I don't know if you've talked to him.
We're going to interview him at some point.
Man, you know, just he really has a way of turning
the
straw that we come up with into gold. He makes these really nice tactile creations using, you know, tools and hand crafting.
In fact, you were just admiring one that I had Tom make
I'm looking at it right now here on your table. It's fairly simple, but it's really appealing because it has one, two, three, five layers. It's like a pyramid going up, and it has five discrete layers. It's very readable. What's this for?
Tootle Tiles.
Ah, yeah.
It's a Mahjong game, and that's the layout, the three-dimensional representation of the layout of the tiles for a Mahjong game. Mm-hmm. And we explain it in the manual, but in this case, a picture is worth a thousand words.
I also find that there's a lot of, you learn a lot about the tactile graphic while you're working on it with your hands. So there's, I think there's a lot of value in being connected to it with your hands. Mm-hmm. For instance, you have a sketch of something or a mental picture of what it's supposed to be, and then you set out to actually craft it with the materials you have, and it inevitably is going to change, because as you're working with it, new ideas are going to come with, you know, it's going to teach you through your hands what it needs to be. That sounds kind of mystical, but there is a certain kind of connection that you have to have with the product in order to make it really good.
What are some examples of some of the most awesome tactile things we've done, or anybody's done? I know one thing that comes to mind for me is that globe, that thing that was, what, I don't know if it was 3 feet in diameter.
Oh, man, yeah.
That was a masterpiece.
That was a truly, yeah, that was before our time. Yeah. And we have not sold that for a long time, I guess, because it, I don't know if it became just prohibitively expensive to create it. But you're right. It's a globe that was probably close to 3 feet in diameter. It was fully, you know, relief, had these high mountain ranges on it and clear outlines of the continents. And it was painted. That was where I think one of the huge expense parts came in, is it was hand painted in different levels of relief. But I don't know. I'd love to see something like that produced again.
Well, what are some other classic examples of some of that kind of...
Well, we've done some nice things here. If you've ever get a chance to look at the Sense of Science tactile materials, that's an ongoing project for science instruction in the early grades. And with each kit, you get a number of... print and tactile images. And for instance, like the Sense of Science animals, I should let Karen talk about this because that's her project, but there's some really nice things there that have been created by hand. And I don't know, certain things, a project that I really had a lot of fondness for was, partly because it was my first big project that I handled, was a set of geometry tactile graphics, and that was really fun for me to work on because I got to relearn geometry that I hadn't touched since ninth or tenth grade, and then also just a chance to correct what I saw were some of the problems that I usually see in tactile graphics. Like with that, I was able to do clear lines that are high, and then also background lines, like for the auxiliary lines, and they were low, and then certain kinds of dashed things. I mean, it's fairly simple. It's very clean and simple kind of thing, but there's a certain kind of satisfying feel to it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I get turned on by some weird things sometimes. But
well, nobody ever accused you of not being a character anyway.
Yeah, really.
What are some of the products that APH has that maybe Blind Cool Tech listeners would be interested in? Well, go ahead.
Well, let's see. What's your demographic? Who's out there listening?
You know, I don't know yet, but I think it's just a little bit of everybody.
Yeah. Well, there's some things that are sort of have a crossover appeal, not just... Our primary focus is on school age materials, and we've done a lot of things for elementary grades and so on, but we've also done a lot of things that I think have a more broad appeal. One is the basic tactile anatomy atlas, and that one was not designed in-house. The graphics were actually done by some university professors in Buffalo, New York. And they did it to help just to help one blind student get through her coursework there in physiology and pre-med courses. I don't know if she ever went on to med school, but they ended up making some really nice drawings. They used this heavy aluminum foil and they tooled them all by hand using the tools in our tactile graphics kit. And they produced over 100 anatomy, physiology, you know, muscular, skeletal, circulatory, respiratory, all these systems, tactile graphics, and each one has its own little text description with it in print and braille. Then they, rather than just sort of stow them away and not use them again, they offered them to the printing house, and we decided that we could use them, and we could find a way to mass produce them. And while at the same time preserving their original masters, which we returned to them. So what we did was we pared those 100-something drawings down to 52 drawings, which were, we kind of weeded out some of the really complex, arcane ones, and we got it down to a more manageable size. And that ends up being a real nice volume. The drawings in it are pretty complex, some of them, very detailed, but they do have a lot of braille labels on them, and you have the braille text on the facing page, which kind of guides your hand through it. Okay. And so you could learn a lot that way. You know, it's interesting just to study and find out things about the human body that you had no idea of.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat, I think.
You know, one that comes to mind for me that would be practical to adults and just about anybody, actually, is that Wheatley Tactile. What is it called? Wheatley Tactile Board or something?
Oh, is that the Picture Maker?
That's it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, Karen can tell you more about that one, but that's pretty neat because it is, you know, it's basically a Velcro board, Velcro pad that has a lot of little detachable shapes, squares, sticks, circles, beads, things of all shapes and textures that you can attach to it to make room layouts, street layouts, simple diagrams right there on the spot. And of course, you know, blind folks can make their own pictures with it, or you could be a teacher trying to illustrate something with it.
Yeah, I know they used that at the guide dog school where I got
little
Jake Meister at. Yeah, the guy carries one around under his arm and whips it out to show you an intersection pattern or whatever. So.
Have you ever talked about quick draw paper?
No.
On this program?
Never. This is a first. You heard it here.
I'll tell you the story about quick draw. We had ordered a bunch of different materials from a company called Ellison that offers just all kinds of craft materials. We wanted to see what's out there, and they sent us a sample pack, and there was this one sheet of material in there, just 8.5 by 11 piece of, yeah, it seemed like sort of thick paper or thin cardboard. And I thought, well, what's this? And then we realized, oh, well, this is a piece of compressed sponge, very compressed sponge. And of course, people who do crafts, what they want to do is they want to cut shapes out of that, and they want to dunk those shapes in water so that up pops a little sponge. So you could cut a little heart shape out of that and then dunk it in water, and it would swell up, and you would have a little heart-shaped stamp or a little heart-shaped sponge that you could dip in ink and then you know, used to stamp your letters and so on with it. So that's what its original purpose was. Well, I was kind of stuffing that back into the bag and looking at the other materials, and I had to sneeze. So phew, I sneezed on this compressed sponge paper. God darned if the thing didn't, you know, swell up in little bumps where I sneezed on it.
This reminds me of the Reese's peanut butter commercial.
Yeah, you something. Got your chocolate and my peanut butter.
You got your swell paper and your saliva.
Yeah, it was a fateful combination. I thought, wow, look at that. Instantly, these little tiny bumps popped up on the thing.
Oh, do they do it instantly?
Oh, yeah, just like that.
I'll be darned.
And so I realized, oh, so quick, you know, ran to the desk and got a marker, a bunch of markers, and started marking on it. Some markers didn't work, and the others did. Wow, you draw on it with this marker, and it swells right up. Excuse me. And so after we experimented, we realized that any water-based marker will work, like a highlighter or, you know, probably the majority of markers, as long as they're not alcohol-based, like a Sharpie or a permanent marker. Those don't seem to work. But, you know, just your basic highlighter marker works great. You draw on the thing, and wherever it's leaving its little watery trail, the line pops up.
That is so cool.
So thus was born Quick Draw Paper, which we now offer as a product in, I think you get 10 sheets in a packet, and you can draw on both sides of the paper. Now, it's not real durable because you can't take it out in the rain or, you know, you can't use it in the shower. And in time, the paper will that you've drawn on will soak up humidity from the air, and eventually it'll get kind of, the image on it will get kind of unreadable because the entire sheet of paper will get kind of scratchy and bubbly and so on. And at that point, you've lost your graphic, but you've gained a perfectly good bathroom sponge. You can just cut the thing apart and use it to scrub your tub.
So how much is a pack of that?
A pack of that is something on the order of $30. It's
it's a little high.
It's a little steep, yeah. The manufacturer stopped making the thinner quick draw paper that we originally sold, and then they started making a slightly thicker version, which is really thicker than we need for our purposes, but it's still very workable.
Yeah.
And they raised the price on it. We don't make the paper in-house, so we're kind of tied by what we pay for it.
Now, is that something that would be appropriate for a blind person themselves to experiment with a little bit of drawing?
Yeah, in fact, in my office, I have a drawing that was done by by a blind child in a kindergarten class. And they did a rainbow and a grassy ground, and it was really neat. It was full color. They were using paints. Mm. And, of course, if you use something as wet and sloppy as paint, the image really pops up on the page. So it was, yeah, it's a great tool. You know, you can just draw on it, and it might be a good way to practice your handwriting, you know, learn to write your alphabet letters. Or you could play tic-tac-toe or just make your own artworks with it.
Yeah,
do your own drawings. And that's really neat because then the blind student can go home and have something to tack up on the refrigerator for mom and dad to see, just like their, you know, sighted brothers and sisters, artwork on the fridge.
Yeah. Is that the best way that a blind person can draw, or are there other tools for?
Well, there's another one that we are just now coming out with. I'm kind of stealing all of Karen's thunder. Ask her about the Draftsman when you see her.
Okay.
That's another tool. It uses some material that's been used in Europe for a few years, and now we're making that available over here. That's kind of another cool way to make instant tactile pictures.
Okay. Well, Fred, it sounds like you have an awful lot of fun at your job here. Are you sure that's legal?
It's just party fun all the time. It's like being in a sandbox, right? You know that.
Oh, yeah.
No, we don't ever have to do meetings or paperwork or budgets or fixing problems or irate phone calls. No, we never have to deal with that. I wish.
How did you get involved with tactile graphics? I mean, you're a sighted guy.
Yeah. Well, I worked in the department for several years as a research assistant, mostly doing editorial work. That was kind of my strength. And anything that I know about computers, which really is just enough to get me in trouble, I've learned here on the job. So. Those first few years of working in the research department were all about soaking up new information, learning Braille, learning what I could about the field of blindness, learning technology. And then, you know, after a while, I started thinking, I asked our supervisor, you know, is there something I could sort of get my feet wet into doing a project of my own? You know, I'd like to take responsibility for a project from start to finish. And she gave me the opportunity to do that, and I kind of had a wide open field to choose from. And the thing that kind of interested me most was this whole tactile picture thing. There was a lot of really good research done on tactile pictures back in the 1970s and 80s here at the printing house. And then it looked like there was just a gap where nothing was really being done on it. And I didn't see a lot of products coming out. And I don't know, it just kind of called to me. And so I asked her if I could do some sort of a tactile project. And she, we brainstormed a little bit and decided that there were, you know, on something kind of simple that I could cut my teeth on. And, you know, that went pretty well. Next thing you know, I'm kind of off and running. I was, there's really not anywhere you can go to get a degree or really even that much useful information in tactile graphic design. I more or less self-taught, although I've sure learned a lot from other people, you know, by attending workshops and going on, occasionally traveling, and then we get a lot of visitors here and people send us a lot of things. So I've learned a lot that way. And of course, with the internet, it's a lot easier to peer into what other people are working on. But, you know, for the most part, it's kind of a way to, I mean, the method is just to kind of feel your way along and hope that you have a good feel for what you're doing.
Feel your way along.
Yeah. pun intended, I guess. So, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
I want to ask you about a project that I think is really cool. I don't even know if we still sell it anymore, though. The one you did with the museum, the art history, is that what it was called? Is that still available?
We do still sell that. We're not making any new ones, but I mean, we're not adding any titles to the series, but we're still producing the ones that we have made. That's called Art History Through Touch and Sound. And that's a whole different method that I could describe real briefly. Again, this is another product that was not developed by the printing house, but we agreed to manufacture. This organization in New York City called Art Education for the Blind, AEB, developed this the content for this big series of art history volumes. And each volume deals with a different epoch or you know, period of art history, like the early Greeks or contemporary Europe or the Baroque period. And each one is an audio and tactile kind of multimedia, if you will, collection. It has each volume that you buy has a guidebook with some text and braille in it, and then it has full print, full color artworks, famous artworks, with a clear tactile ink laid right on top of them. And that's done through a silkscreen process. We actually had those done by a company in Japan, and they were able to lay down clear, see-through ink right on top of the print work of art. And there's also clear braille right on top of the print text, so that you know, the visual experience is there, but there's also a tactile element to it. So it's very attractive kind of book. You know, it still has that sort of artistic appeal that's important, you know, obviously when you're dealing with works of art. And there's the audio component is a set of cassettes that guide you through it. So it not only are they guiding your hands along and telling you what your fingers are experiencing. In other words, they'll say, okay, feel from the top left. Here you'll feel a bumpy texture. Move your hand down about an inch. Now you'll see a line that goes across. This represents the mandolin or the top of the mandolin that the girl is holding. Then if you follow that down to the left, you'll find her hand. Notice that it's shaped like a triangle. This is because Picasso was experimenting with this cubist media or idiom, or I don't know. I don't really know much about art history. Somehow they picked me, about the most inappropriate person they could have picked, to be the kind of the project manager on that, and just to see that it got through all of our production processes okay. And it about killed me, but it was we did it, and we produced 6 volumes, 6 different topics. And one of the neat ones in there that I would recommend if people are interested in looking into it is called The Building Blocks of Art. And instead of being about a particular era in art history, it's basically kind of a universal tour of the language of art and some of the concepts that are commonly used in painting, sculpture, and architecture. So they will talk about perspective and depth, and they'll talk about foreshadowing, or how a painter is able to make it look like the arm is reaching out of the painting toward you, or something is far off in the background. And they'll talk about architectural terms like, what is a cantilever? How can this part of the building stick way out over the lower part of the building? It looks like it would fall off, but because of the way the weight is counterbalanced or cantilevered, they're able to do that. And they'll talk about arches and how an arch is a stable structure, and sculpture, and you know, different kinds of sculpture, how they're made by casting or by you know, chipping away at stone, and all those really neat concepts in there. So you can really learn a lot of the vocabulary of art that really, I think, builds up your appreciation for it a lot.
Yeah,
I'd recommend that Building Blocks volume.
And do I understand correctly that those are available in some libraries?
Yeah, there was a big push on to get all of those volumes carried by all of the talking book libraries, the NLS, you know, National Library Service program. And I know they bought, or actually there was a grant that was able to place a volume of the first volume we produced in every library. But, you know, I'm not sure that NLS followed up completely to the point where they've got all 6 volumes in all libraries.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you if that happened or not.
So there is a chance that the listeners could go to their talking book library and at least look at these, if not have them send them to them. I don't guess they'll do that.
Huh? I don't know if they, you know, how they work that, whether they're lent out or not. It seems like they ought to be, but...
So you might want to check with your library on that. Definitely recommend those. All right, Fred. Well, I don't want to keep you forever. You're always a fascinating character
to
talk to.
I gotta go. I'm just getting warmed up. I'd love to return if I ever think of anything more to say.
Do you want to give folks your contact info?
Absolutely, and I would really like to hear from people if they have ideas for you know, tactile graphic or tactile learning products that we could maybe manufacture. If you have any prototypes or samples or techniques that you want to share, I would love to hear those too. It's that's definitely a way we get a lot of our best ideas, is, you know, people calling us up or emailing us. So again, my name is Fred Otto, and the last name is Otto, and my email is fotto@aph.org, fotto@aph.org. And that'd probably do it.
Yeah.
I could give out my phone number if you'd like.
Well, it's up to you. I mean,
yeah, you can reach us at our toll-free number, and but email is always a good way to do it if you, and I probably do have that.
Yeah. I bet they do if they're getting the podcast.
Yeah.
Probably.
So I'd like to hear from you and tell them that Blind Cool Tech sent you, and I'll know. Oh, that somebody listened.
Right. Anything else that I didn't ask you that I should have that's important to know about tactile graphics? Or?
No, I just want to say Blind Cool Tech rules, man.
rocks and minerals. And I understand you're getting ready to start up your own podcast.
We're doing a lot of, we're just collecting a lot of recordings. My wife and I, we carry our little recorder around with us a lot of places, and just, you know, trying to get colorful events and strange events that happen to you on there. So, I guess once we get something that we think is interesting enough, we'll put it up.
Well, cool. Maybe, yeah, maybe you'll even submit some pieces to Blind Cool Tech, huh?
I'd like that.
You know what? That's my book part alarm going off.
Uh-oh.
That means it's 4 o'clock.
You're busted. All right, guys. Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us, Fred.
See you, Larry.
You've been listening to Blind Cool Tech. Visit us on the web at blindcooltech.com. Our email address is blindcooltech@gmail.com, and our comment line is 206-984-9203.